Remember that the future is in our hands. Stay well, my friends. Continue to struggle for justice and peace and create a world where all can live in harmony and peace. You've been listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. I am Cecil, and I will speak with you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. I'm John Nelson. Today on the Old Mole, Lori Mercier talks with Alyssa Walker Keller of the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition about their work supporting immigrants' rights and the challenges faced by this Republican administration's aggressive ICE operations. Norm Diamond pays tribute to theoretician, teacher, and activist Eleni Varikas, and Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss the Republican administration's order to remove references to slavery and black history from museums, parks, and military bases all across the country. Stick around for that. First up this episode, Lori Mercier speaking with coordinator for the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, Alyssa Walker Keller, about immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE, and the PIRC's work supporting immigrants' rights through legal support and direct assistance, education, and advocacy. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, here's Lori Mercier.
Good morning. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Portland Immigration Rights Coalition coordinator Alyssa Walker Keller about the important work of PIRC. Welcome back to KBOO, Alyssa. Hi, thanks for having me, Laurie. Well, the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, or PIRC as it's widely known, has been around for about 2 decades. Can you tell us something about the history and founding of the organization in the early 2000s?
Yeah, I'm happy to. That actually is the incredible work of a lot of grassroots organizers from across the metro area who, back in around 2006 or so, formed the organization in response to the attacks on immigrant communities, such as the Sensenbrenner Bill. And then shortly thereafter, began a hotline to report ICE activity. And that really stemmed from like a need from community during the Del Monte raids, where we saw a number of our immigrant community neighbors detained and transferred out of state. And so there kind of was this gathering of folks who thought, you know, what can we do to support our neighbors? And they came together with a hotline that initially was just a phone that got passed around from organizer to organizer, later became a hotline that was a little bit more in the traditional sense. And we've been plugging along ever since in different iterations. The seasons have ebbed and flowed. In 2016, with the election and the first Trump administration, was when I learned about PIRC, and I was a hotline dispatcher for a couple of years. And that work has continued basically, I believe, continuously since then, in terms of having a hotline available for community.
Right. And we'll make sure to post that hotline number on the KBOO website and we'll announce it at the end of our discussion. But you mentioned the ramping up of ICE activities and deportations of our communities in Oregon in 2016. What do you think has been the impact of this last year with Trump 2.0? And that administration's very aggressive and violent ICE operations compared to previous years of ICE and Border Patrol operations.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to remember is that ICE is not an institution that's been around for a super long time. And since 9/11 was when the Department of Homeland Security formed this office. And so I like to remind people that ICE as an agency is barely, in its early 20s, and therefore, is not a fundamental need that our community has. We've seen, I think with the first Trump administration, we really saw kind of a gloves off like vitriol and attacks on immigrant community members. But this administration has been even more intense for folks who have a recent immigration history in terms of both the narrative that's being spread about them, the attacks on their ability to go about life and work and school and be members of our society. We see a lot of flagrant open racism. And this administration has also really pushed for the use of ICE as a tool to detain people who have been in community, whether that's for, 20 years and who are contributing members of our neighborhoods, or if they are recently arrived and seeking political asylum and other protected statuses. It's painting our immigrant neighbors with a really broad brush as people who we don't want in our communities. And I just think that that is been one of the horrific impacts is that sense of mistrust and fear that has been sown in our neighborhoods.
Well, that the extent of the racism has been pretty flagrant and shocking and horrific. The fact that ICE has really targeted Black and Brown folks rather than Ukrainian or other Europeans who may be documented. There's been this, obvious targeting of certain people that's been, I imagine, quite distressing.
For sure. And I think when we've witnessed a lot of ICE activity in the last year, increasingly, but especially in the last 3 months of last year, there was a real serious escalation in what ICE has called Operation Black Rose. And there's lots of good reporting about that. And what we've learned from that is there was a real intentional effort to be in neighborhoods where immigrant communities were likely to be, and to do a lot of profiling and arresting of people before they had a warrant, or and using an administrative warrant rather than a judicial warrant. So kind of a detain first, ask questions later policy that has, of course, had a really profound, terrifying impact on our neighborhoods.
Well, have the strategies that PIRC volunteers have employed changed with these new strategies of ICE in the last year?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've had to really get good at is training people well to know what to expect, because ICE continues to evolve its strategies. And so we continue to have to evolve our trainings. And then working really closely with coalition partners from Oregon for All Coalition, Protect Oregon, Deportation Defense Coalition, just folks who are out there thinking about how are we showing up for our community at this time. And so whether it's a nonprofit that's working really hard to provide Know Your Rights information and trainings, or direct services agencies accompanying families, when somebody is detained, there's a lot left behind. There's a lot of pieces to pick up, whether that's the vehicle that they were traveling in, child care to be arranged, new jobs to be found for the person who's now going to have to be the primary breadwinner. And our direct service agency neighbors and partners have just done like such an incredible job finding resources from nothing. We have a lot of mutual aid groups that have done really incredible work to create GoFundMes when there's no resource available. From an agency, sometimes these are the folks who are crowdsourcing support for families so that there's money in the commissary so that the family member who's detained can call their loved ones. And then in terms of our rapid response strategies, we've had to get, we've really been working hard to train up a lot of people because we really believe that the more folks who know how to record and report ICE activity, the faster we can respond when somebody calls us and says that they believe ICE is nearby, and that helps us document what's happening. It may be the difference between someone's release or not if we're able to document how ICE has behaved in ways that are not legal.
Well, let's talk a bit more about this kind of amazing coalition building that PERC has done that seems to have been very successful in bringing together lots of different groups and individuals to build an immigrant justice community across the state of Oregon. Can you tell us how that coalition works? Is it formal, or is it just mutual aid and volunteers that show up? I know that every time I go to the South Waterfront, there are dozens or hundreds of people protesting in front of ICE. So I'm just wondering about the level of coordination, or if this is really kind of spontaneous drive of people here to stand up for immigrant communities.
That's a great question because it's a little bit of everything. Despite having coalition in our name, we became ourselves a nonprofit a couple of years ago. And so we're members of a number of coalitions, and those organizations began, working close to the beginning of this administration to think about how to respond in a really intentional way. Some of these were relationships we already had because PERC was historically kind of based in the metro area. Some of the relationships are a little bit newer because we've become a statewide organization as a result. And in terms of what you see happening out at the South Waterfront, a lot of it is a lot of different folks with a diversity of tactics, whether it's community members, people who are, protesting ICE activity, or us. Our role in that has been to provide legal observers who are communicating and connecting with those who have to go into the building for appointments, helping, collect information so that in the event that they don't come out, we're able to activate rapid response legal support from some of our other coalition partners through the Echo Network. And so there's lots of different roles being played by lots of different people and organizations. PERC tries really hard to like stay in our lane and do the thing that we do really well, which is activating rapid response and providing those legal observers who specifically are observing ICE activity.
Do you want to say something about the PERC's training program, Migro Watch? Because it does seem like this is such an important activity all around the metro area as well as the state, enabling this kind of rapid response.
And part of the beauty of that training is that it was developed by a number of different people from a number of different organizations who have been working really hard for a long time to verify ICE activity. We started to realize that there was going to be a need for a more intentional training program that led to people being incorporated into our networks. And so, together with folks from organizations like Unidos and Latino Network and Together Lab and Innovation Law Lab and Clear Clinic, and probably some that I'm forgetting to mention right now, we developed this training, and then PERC has kind of held a lot of the expanding of getting that training out there to a lot of organizations. And lots of our, coalition partners have their own versions of the training as well. So the trainings that we're doing are really intended to help people know how to recognize ICE, how to know what information to record and report when they call our hotline so that we can activate a rapid response as best as possible. Because, just like a video advice activity often isn't enough information for us to be able to provide support for the person. It's really collecting information about what the incident looked like, how the tactics ICE used, and then as much as possible, getting that biographical information to be able to connect people to legal resources as quickly as possible.
Well, that work is so important. Another feature of PERC's website, you have some great resources that I want to make sure that we highlight here. In fact, I carry one around with me that, sort of articulates what people should or should not say to ICE or, in terms of knowing our rights. But it also seems like this mapping that you've done on the website is quite useful, noting what people call in to report, where people have been picked up. And sort of looking at that map, it seems like, there have been most of these arrests have been in Washington County and with Multnomah County a close second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, especially in the last 3 months of last year. It was really clear that ICE was targeting really specific communities and really specific parts of communities even. So we started sharing that information, I believe, in October, just trying to be as transparent as possible to communities so people can make, educated decisions about how to live their lives, what times of day to go out, what communities may or may not be experiencing more activity from ICE. There's so much agency that people are having taken from them right now to decide how they're going to go about their lives. This administration is doing everything it can to make people be afraid to leave their homes, to be in community with their loved ones, to be participating in society. And we really believe that knowledge is power. And so like any information we can get out to people, with our limited resources and capacity to make sure that people know what they need to know to make decisions is really a goal of the organization. We really believe that people's rights are best protected when all of us know our rights, be those children, elders, people born here, people born other places. And we're working together to protect one another's rights because all of us are impacted by this, immigrant or not.
Well, Oregon has a sanctuary statute. I think it dates back to 1987 or sometime in the 80s. And I'm wondering if PERC believes that Oregon has been helpful in stepping up its support and challenging Trump's executive orders in order to protect immigrants' rights.
Yeah, I think we have the gift of being one of the oldest and definitely the strongest sanctuary policies in the nation. And, there were really intentional organizing efforts that happened in the 2020s as well to pass the Sanctuary Promise Act as well to really codify some of those protections. And, we're in communication frequently with folks from different levels of elected office. And I think that there's a real desire from those offices to do something that's important and protective of their constituents right now. And I will also say that it's really important for us to continue to encourage them to do so, because ultimately electeds are supposed to reflect the voice of their constituents. And that means making our voices heard. If all of us believe that what's happening is wrong on really fundamental levels, then it's our duty as people who can communicate that to electeds to do so and to let them know that we're standing with them, that we want them to be bold, that we want them to take action and pass protective measures to keep our whole community safer. Because we're not safe when people are patrolling the streets with masks and weapons and snatching our neighbors out of their vehicles. The thing we say is that they're leaving, broken glass and broken hearts and broken families. And that's not what Oregon's about.
And yeah, and long-term trauma. Mm-hmm. A final question, Alyssa. Because I know I've heard people ask this about what happens to folks who are detained in the Portland ICE facility and then sent to the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma. How does PERC coordinate, or does PERC coordinate legal assistance once people are sent to another state?
Yeah, that's a great question, a little bit complex to answer. There's a really limited amount of time before somebody is transferred out of that field office, be it at McAdam or Eugene or in Medford. There's a couple of them across the state. And especially here close to the Washington border, if someone is transferred out of here, it becomes that much harder for our legal partners to do their next steps in terms of providing representation. So we try to move as quickly as possible to get, the biographical information we know and the details of a detention to folks from ECHO, whether that's the rapid response attorneys who are providing support on the ground Monday through Thursday, or the ECHO network at large. They've been doing really intentional work to provide support to people. And sometimes that means people don't end up actually getting transferred out of the field office. Sometimes they're released and allowed to continue their case in community. Sometimes people are transferred to Tacoma, and then our legal partners are able to continue coordinating support, you know, once they are not in the state. It just becomes a lot harder, though, to find, you know, that extra legal assistance when people are already in detention and far away. So time is really of the essence, and we do everything we can to connect people as quickly as possible to those who are doing really important legal supports. Really, it's kind of a relay. We hand off the relationship and the information as quickly as we can so that our legal partners can take it from there.
Well, thank you so much, Alyssa Walker Keller, a coordinator of the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition. Thank you for all the work that you're doing and for taking time out today. I know you're super busy to talk with us on KBOO. And I'll just announce the PERC hotline. People should write it on their hands or, you know, make sure that you have it handy at all times. It's 1-888-622-1510. And we'll also post some links to the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition website, which has lots of great resources available. Thanks again, Alyssa.
Thank you, Lori. And yeah, if there's one thing that folks take away, I hope it's that you save the phone number and check out our website and learn how to record and report. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey!
was Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We heard from Elena and Los Fulanos as well, featuring Rosario Reyes. The track was titled Amor Migrante. Up next, Norm Diamond paying tribute to Eleni Varikas, theoretician, author, contributor to the Old Mole, and so much more. She passed away in January. Here's Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio.
Eleni Varikas, renowned feminist theoretician, teacher, and activist, died this January, 76 years old. Eleni had a connection to Portland and continued a friend to the founders of the Old Mole Variety Hour. She taught in women's studies at Portland State University in the early 1980s. Eleni, as I remember, was born into a political family in Athens in 1949. As a student at the University of Athens, she was active in the resistance to the military dictatorship that ruled Greece. When the French rose up in 1968, the closest we've come to a genuine revolution in an advanced capitalist country, her father encouraged her to go to Paris, join in, and learn what she could from the upheaval. That 1968 Parisian uprising gave her a political direction for life, and it gave her a second city to call home in Paris. Eleni returned to Greece after the fall of the dictatorship in 1974, where she became active in revolutionary politics. One of the things she did was served on the editorial board of the journal Odophragma. The English would be The Barricade. In 1976, she was sentenced to prison for translating and circulating a book that ended up banned in many European countries, The Little Red Book for School Children and High School Students. In case you don't remember this Little Red Book, and I have just found it online and ordered my own copy, it was an effort to encourage youngsters to mark out their own paths and rethink society anew, a sort of version of Mao Zedong's Little Red Book, but this one with the message of don't trust anyone over 30, if you remember that slogan. Instead of what Mao said about the United States, this Little Red Book began, all adults are paper tigers. The book was banned often because of its information about abortion and sexuality. Eleni was later acquitted on appeal. I do not remember whether she served time. I have to guess that she did not. Starting in the late 1970s, she turned more directly to feminist studies and feminist activism, becoming one of the leaders of that movement in Greece. In the early 1980s, she returned to Paris to write her doctoral dissertation, La Révolte des Dames, Women's Revolt, on the history of Greek feminism. It was during that period that she graced us with her presence here in Portland. The Daniel Singer Foundation, Daniel, another friend of mine, Daniel having been another great French intellectual, historian of the French uprising in 68, and also a visitor to Portland, calls Eleni one of the major figures in feminist political theory and gender studies in the Francophone world. She played a decisive role in introducing and theorizing the concept of gender in French intellectual life, helping to reshape entire fields of research. Very little of Eleni's work is available in English, so her reconsideration of the concept of gender and her focus on what she called pariahs is largely unknown in our country and our movement. Particularly the latter emphasis is valuable, an emphasis on those who are marginalized, those who are excluded, those she called pariahs, those who are excluded when we talk about universal human rights, or what we might mean by freedom. As the Singer Foundation said, her thinking bridged Marxism, feminism, and critical theory, and spoke directly to questions of democracy, emancipation, and injustice in the modern world. Eleni was life partner to, and sometimes co-author with, Michael Lewy, many of whose own important works have been translated into English. Michael, of course, accompanied her to Portland. As the Singer Foundation summarizes well, for those who knew her personally, Eleni's intellectual brilliance was inseparable from her warmth, generosity, and irrepressible joie de vivre. She was known for her magnetic presence, her iconoclastic spirit, her deep erudition, and her unwavering moral seriousness and political commitment. Eleni embodied an exceptional combination of political rigor, intellectual independence, and human kindness. Eleni Barikas leaves behind a rich and enduring body of work and a legacy of solidarity, feminism, and critical thought that will continue to inspire generations. This has been Norm Diamond, remembering a one-time brief resident of Portland who's had an impact on the world.
That was Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour, remembering Eleni Varikas and Debout Les Femmes, performed by the Grand Est Collective in 2022. The song title translates to Rise Up Women. To close things out this episode, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with another Left in the Law segment. This time their focus is monumental racism, and you're hearing it here on KBOO Community Radio.
Among the blizzard of Trump's executive orders in early 2025 was a directive called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. This order launched an aggressive campaign to remove from federal museums, parks, and other sites content related to slavery, Jim Crow laws, and racism as a structural feature of U.S. history. The order proclaims that, quote, over the past decade, Americans have witnessed a concerted and widespread effort to rewrite our nation's history, replacing objective facts with a distorted narrative written by ideology rather than truth, unquote. Like most Trumpian pronouncements, the order must be understood in its Orwellian rhetorical reversals. In actuality, this regime is indeed rewriting our nation's history of replacing objective facts with a distorted narrative driven by white supremacist ideology. Well, Mike, this is Black History Month, and that history is more critical than ever to protect and defend. Can we start with the scope of Trump's sweeping agenda of whitewashing U.S. history and the legal tools the regime enlists in carrying it out?
Well, Jen, it is Black History Month, and it's 100th anniversary. In 1926, Carter Woodson created what was then called Negro History Week, which expanded to Black History Month because the U.S. government refused to tell the truth about itself, quote unquote. So Trump is really going both large and small in a systematic effort to essentially eliminate any reference to Black experience or subjective experience and the objective truth of the impact of slavery, the history of the United States from Reconstruction through World War II in particular. And he's doing it large and small. He's doing it small in that there is no place that is safe within the governmental system of states and federal government. He's ordered that Medgar Evers' house in Mississippi, where Medgar Evers, a civil rights stalwart, was killed. And the fact that he was killed by a racist named Byron Beckwith, who was head of a local Ku Klux Klan, has been eliminated. They don't want divisive words like racist to ever be uttered out loud. There is a marvelous plantation in Louisiana, the Whitney's Plantation. This eccentric lawyer bought it and is developing it to show in some detail the realities of slavery. You know, the South was the most profitable part of the entire world prior to the Civil War, with the discovery of the cotton gin and England's ability to distribute goods. The price of cotton was very high, and it was monstrously effective as a system of generating money. And how the plantation system worked is never been detailed in the same way that it is at the Whitney Plantation, where you can see the slave quarters. The whole system of managing slaves, of utilizing slaves, is really on display. Well, they've lost federal grants that they had relied on. Fortunately, they're not entirely reliant on federal grants, but Trump canceled them. He's eliminated any reference to the experience. So in the words of Alan Spears, you can now talk about MLK overcoming. You just can't talk about what he overcame. And that's similar to what the owner of the Whitney Museum said. He says, Black people are told, you just have to get over it. Why can't you get over it? But what is the it that they're supposed to get over? You know, efforts to display that or detail that are being frustrated at every turn insofar as the federal government has been involved.
Well, Trump cannot get over the loss of the 2020 election, and he cannot get over the struggles that he confronted around the racial justice movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the early years of his first administration when the Unite the Right protests that involved the Ku Klux Klan, Nazi symbols, and assertion of Southern white supremacy as central to American culture. That whole Charlottesville protest that involved the death of a woman that was part of the counter protest. And of course, Trump famously saying in 2017, well, there are fine people on both sides, which was a nod to the right wing and the far right. What do you make of this decade that Trump has his own grievances here, right? The man of major grievances, he does not give up. We talked last time about this man does not give up a grudge. He carries a grudge, nurses it. And he's really mad at this movement that confronted him during his first administration. And then he had to sit out Biden's response to the Black Lives Matter movement during the Biden years. And this really aggrieved him. What do you think this round of executive orders is in the context of that history? And then maybe we can also take up earlier waves of racial just advances of civil rights of Black people, and then the backlash of racism and white nationalism.
Well, 2017 had a powerful response. That happened along with the killing of all these people in the Charleston, South Carolina church. And then, capped by the whole George Floyd incident, there was a real backlash against all the sculptures and monuments created by disgruntled Southerners after the loss of the Civil War. Especially in the 1890s, the early 20th century, there were monuments built to Confederate generals. Monuments to white supremacy were built all over the South, huge concrete, steel and iron, brass and bronze monuments, substantial statements of white supremacy built in towns that were at least half Black.
And historians have emphasized that these monuments were not about so much about preserving history as serving as forms of intimidation against black people.
So these monuments started to be removed, and they were systematically removed. And there were
important history lessons. I remember here in Portland how much teaching was being done around these monuments, what they represented, why some of them were taken down, Jefferson and Washington. And of course, there were controversies, as is always the case, around monuments that were not associated with the Confederacy, but also were associated with the history of slavery. But it was a wrenching time, and also a very profoundly instructive time about opening up parts of history that you walk by those monuments in the park blocks or other areas of the city, and you didn't think twice about them until they came down and there was a movement to around, you know, major civics lessons around what those monuments represented.
Yeah, Trump has a version of history, I think, that he learned in the fourth grade and has never moved past. You can see that clearly in what he did with the George Washington Monument in Philadelphia. You know, during the Revolutionary War, George Washington lived for much of it in Philadelphia. And what happened in Philadelphia was that they created, the city did, a monument, or rather a displays of George Washington, and part of it included his relationship to slavery. You can see a more rounded view of Washington in Ken Burns' Revolutionary War PBS piece, where Washington is portrayed in all his strengths, his patience, his understanding, but he's also portrayed as a property developer, a man with ambitions, and a man who owned 110 slaves of his own and who married very well and whose wife brought with her 200 more slaves. And that he spent much of his time managing these slaves along with managing his other estates. And it portrays closer to a whole person. Our founding fathers were a lot more complicated than Donald Trump can imagine. They had all the most noble and all the basest forms of humanity within them and lived them out all over the place. And Trump wants to snip off anything that might lead to complex considerations. He doesn't want slavery to be essentially acknowledged or discussed at all. He wants to have it have been a time of fun in the plantation, I guess. He doesn't want the full human complexity of the people who started this country to be discussed at all.
You know, I think there's also a deep resonance here of this idea of thou protestest too much, that the scope of it confesses to this enormous insecurity of these people, Trump among them, and on some level knowing that Black people have created a lot of what is American culture, and people of color, brown people, Native people, but Black people have a particular place, I think, in producing so much of the music, culture, art, literature, sports, you know, that has kind of represented and struggle, histories of struggle that have represented so much of the beauty and the aesthetics of American culture. And so this attempt, this kind of crude attempt to wipe all that out is itself, it confesses enormous insecurity on the part of this ruling class.
And a hidden, long simmering guilt about slavery. Slavery was a very big deal in this country. I mean, slavery could indeed be an essential part of the formation of capitalism. It's when slavery in the New World, slavery in Jamaica and the southern U.S. enabled huge amounts of profits to be stored and invested, and then the whole systematic process of continually evolving. I mean, slavery can be seen as, you know, just as purely as a moral stain, especially the institutionalization of it, or it can be seen as some, you know, ironic source of everything, some basis for the development of an economy that has now enabled the world and women and people to have, in truth, more freedom than they've ever had, than they had 1,000 years ago. But it's a complicated topic, and one that Trump doesn't want to get anywhere near, that the slave, the pain, the misery, the daily reality of slavery is something that, you know, they instinctively are aware of and feel, and that's precisely what they want to get away from, any discussion of it. And of course, discussion requires acknowledgement. So they don't want to even acknowledge that it happened in the U.S. His definition of what the Smithsonian Institute should do is focus on happy and bright things, uplifting things, up with people, inspiring things. Nothing bad about anything that ever happened in the United States of America.
Well, let's talk some about the legal tools for carrying this out, because Congress has passed laws on a number of fronts. We're finding that these executive orders and the tools of the executive branch are working around on, you know, many areas of American life. But with the renaming of military bases, you particularly see this kind of sinister and crude attempt to claw back history, including a commission that was established in 2023 under the Biden administration to change the names of military bases named after Confederate generals.
You know, the U.S. Army was not really present in the South until the early 20th century, the Reconstruction having been effectively ended by Southerners. But when the Army came back to the South, it was at a time when the Lost Cause ideology was at its peak. So they wanted to and succeeded in getting Army bases named after Confederates.
And Woodrow Wilson, famed for League of Nations, was a very committed Southern racist who
absolutely
supported the Klan, played Birth of Nation in the White House, said it was a mistake to pursue Reconstruction in the South, and that it was a mistake to grant leadership roles to Black people. I mean, it was just virulently racist. And that was part of that era of monument building, that first era.
Well, so we have Fort Bragg in North Carolina, a really big, major Army base. Fort Bragg was named after Braxton Bragg, who I met first in reading U.S. Grant's autobiography, which is a really great read, by the way. It's very clear, unpretentious, direct. And Braxton Bragg was a Confederate general who was widely hated by his people over whom he presided. There was one or two attempts to kill him by his own side, who was a bad general. And who,
during the Civil War.
During the Civil War. And he was soundly defeated by General Grant in Tennessee. And Grant then moved on down and succeeded in taking Vicksburg, gaining the Mississippi River for the Union, and then got called back by Lincoln, who knew a good man when he saw one, and became the general of the whole Union movement. General Grant, by the way, the book, you learned that military battles are about 85% about keeping your huge army fed and watered and depriving the other guy of food and water. But anyway, Braxton Bragg was generally looked down upon by anybody who knew about the military on both the South and the North. And yet they're fighting hard to have his name preserved as the name of a Southern base. And they're so weaselly because there's now a law saying you cannot name anything after a Confederate. Confederates were traitors after all.
Well, there are hundreds of monuments, but there were, what, 9 bases that were the focus of this law by the Naming Commission that recommended changing the names of 9 Army bases, 2 Navy ships, and other recommendations that were involved bases around the country, right?
Well, what they did to solve the problem of having a law saying they cannot name these bases, any of these bases, after Confederates, is that they found some ordinary soldier in the enormous records of all the people who've served for the U.S. Army who had the same name. So they named Fort Bragg after Leonard Bragg, who was like a private first class during the World War II, who has now been cleverly picked up by Pete Hegseth in the Pentagon. And so they got its name Fort Bragg again, even though technically it's not, they have not violated the law.
You know, this reminds me of Herbert Marcuse talked about this concept of surplus repression, that there are forms of repression that produce the opposite effect as that which it intends because it's so excessive. And I think this is an example of what Marcuse would call surplus repression. It's like people now have to think about both what was there after this Confederate base named after a Confederate general, but then they also have to think about it's not really back to him. It's some other trickery involved. So you have to kind of follow the moves here, not even effective in it as a strategy in a certain way to rewrite history, as violent as it is.
Yeah, well, yeah, I have to say they bring to this talk the existence of the Equal Justice Institute in Alabama, because history and memory is being developed at a remarkable pace and in a brilliant way in Montgomery, Alabama, by Brian Stevenson and the people with whom he works. Brian was a death penalty lawyer in the 80s, and in 1989 or 90, he founded the Equal Justice Institute. And I think he was really impressed by what Germany did with so many specific sites in Germany where Jews were peremptorily killed or captured, where they're actually marked with monuments so that they won't be forgotten. And one of the many things they've done in Montgomery is learned about every lynching they possibly can, every lynching that took place, and there were thousands, 4,400 of them they've identified. Since between Reconstruction in the late 19th century and the beginning of World War II. And they have created monuments for each of these in Owensboro, Kentucky, all over Mississippi, all over Alabama and Florida. There are little towns, there are bigger towns, where lynchings took place. Often lynchings were celebrated. They were picnics where children were brought to. And the reality of lynching is laid out at Montgomery in a remarkable museum and in a huge monument where all these monuments to each of the lynchings is contained, and in a sculpture park right on the Alabama River. And the museum itself is brilliant. It begins, it's a history of transatlantic slavery. It begins with a huge wave of water, like you're looking at the ocean. And it uses every imaginable technique, including holographic people. It depicts vividly the whole course of being transported, of being used as a slave in the U.S., the numbers. There were some 13 million Africans taken from Africa to the New World, mostly the United States and Brazil and the Caribbean. And all of that history and continues up to the present day. And it's developed in a museum and in a big, this huge sort of legacy center, a really striking place where the pillars, similar to like the one in 2001, like a big tablet, huge, like 8 feet tall for each lynching. And some towns, some old towns, have actually taken these and moved them back and located them at the site of a lynching. So the process of memory and history is booming in Montgomery right now. I strongly recommend people to go there and check it out.
They have a wonderful website also that has some very vivid description and materials around their work.
And fortunately, it's not dependent on the government. So yeah, it's not, Trump's can thrash and moan all he wants, but they're going to continue to develop and present meaningful images of history, of narratives of history, and to make sure that the whole process from the beginning of Black people's forcible presence in the United States to this moment, they're very talented people are watching over and developing many ways of expressing that.
So we will continue to see a return of the repressed, and that there has always been a struggle for history for oppressed groups and having to be creative and continually engaged in, you know, struggle and alliances around keeping the, not only the moral responsibility to acknowledge the history of suffering of people whose lives and bodies were the basis for producing the wealth and power of the regimes that are, including the current one in power, but also how much there's to be learned from those histories and how interesting the histories are. There's both a moral weight and tragedy attached to it, but also lessons about survival under very difficult conditions, of creative ways of subverting power, of resisting power. So for me, discovering the intersection of women's history and Black history and Latino history, it's a richer, more interesting history than that flat, flaccid kind of white bread notion of history that the Trump regime promotes.
Well, that's true. It's a dialectic process too. It's the very success of the systematic removal of Confederate monuments from all over the South and the renaming of these bases that has led to Trump's repression and the return, the whole lost cause ideology of white supremacy in the U.S., which rallied strongly after the Civil War and then is now really taken some big hits. And Trump is the vehicle for their efforts to reestablish their primacy.
Thanks, Mike, for joining me here on this Monday of Black History Month. And we honor the many historians and Black Americans who continue to struggle and have produced a lot of what really is important about U.S. history. See you next month for Women's Month.
Okay, I look forward to it.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 16th of March, 2026. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, and Norm Diamond, and to Lori Mercier and her guest, Alyssa Walker-Keller. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes in time at kboo.fm. Just search for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the KBOO website at kboo.fm. We'll be right back.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. Somehow, the Metal March returns again